From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we hear how a dance class can double as spiritual practice.
When you dance for Yemaya and your skirt is like the waves of the ocean and you're singing and hearing those drums, I mean, you can't not feel the spirituality.
Then we dig into the roots of American music.
We could look at any type of American music and trace back and find the Afro-Latino, Afro-Caribbean, and Latino roots in the music.
And we talk to a local author about a book that might keep you up at night.
They're just kind of like laying you down in bed and tucking you goodnight and being like, here's a little nightmare for you to have later.
Don't be scared. It's Cross Currents. Stay with us. There's a saying for some people who take dance classes regularly.
Dance is my church. You hear people saying that phrase all the time because there's a release to it.
That's dancer Stella Adelman. She's talking about an Afro-Cuban folkloric dance class that she takes at Dance Mission Theater in San Francisco. But these classes aren't just about exercise. For some people, they can also double as a spiritual practice. KALW's Lila Day takes us there.
3 drummers sit next to one another in an echoey dance classroom. Each has a drum shaped like a giant hourglass that lays across their lap sideways. With each smack of their hand, it looks like they're scooping air into the drum's leather head. That's Susana Arenas-Pedroso. She's explaining the roots of the Cuban orisha, or god, El Igua. A group of about 10 dancers watch on. Pedroso was born and raised in Havana, Cuba.
Orisha is like the way we walk, the way we eat, the way we express.
Pedroso is a well-known teacher in the Bay Area, a place that has built a reputation for having world-class Afro-Cuban folklore instructors. Like many teachers here, Pedroso is a former dancer from a Cuban company that was on tour in the U.S., but she decided to stay.
We open the ceremony with a lengua, and we close the ceremony with a lengua.
Afro-Cuban rhythms are rooted in Africa, from the Yoruba people. In the very Catholic-colonized Cuba, African slaves were forbidden to practice their Yoruba religion. The Spaniards forced them to adopt Catholicism, but many silently refused and came up with an alternative.
When I went to the church for Virgen de Regla, it made me feel good. Made me feel because you had to cross the water and then you bring flowers, and it's part of life of Cuban people too.
Pedroso is remembering visits to a Catholic church in Havana. This Catholic church has a double life. It's also the church of the African goddess Yemanja. In Cuba, they call this synchronism. Some Cubans go to the Catholic churches to pray, but they're actually worshiping African gods using the images of the Catholic ones. The syncretic religion has a name, Santeria. Today, about 10 dancers are in the class, all wearing long flowing skirts. They know very well that Yemanja represents the movement of the water. Their skirts twirl in unison through the room, sounding like flags in the wind. Usually, Yemanja is calm like a Caribbean wave, but when she gets agitated, she swirls around, kicks her feet, and like the ocean in a storm, she turns from smooth and easy to a turbulent, defiant force.
When you dance for Yemanja and your skirt is like the waves of the ocean and you're crossing the floor and moving your skirt around and singing and hearing those drums, I mean, you can't not feel the spirituality.
Purusha Sand comes to the class frequently. Like some of the other dancers, she often brings her son with her. The kids sit in the corner, surrounded by twirling colors as bright as their crayons. Sand tells me she doesn't come because she practices Santeria religion. For her, the dance is a physical and mental release.
I think it's just like, I'm a nurse and I deal with a lot of like sick people throughout the day, and just not thinking about any of that and just... You know, going back to feeling and just being in your body and not thinking so much.
5, 6, 7. One more time. Down. Down. Now make a turn. Yes?
The dancers line up and move across the floor, their shoulders rolling like waves. The women in the class today completely embody this Orisha, Yemanja. Still, most of them tell me they aren't actually followers of the Santeria religion, including Stella Adelman.
You know, I'm a white American atheist Jew, but here I'm doing a dance form that is religious.
Adelman's been studying Afro-Cuban folkloric dance since she learned about it years ago on a visit to Cuba.
I love Xangô, who is the Orisha of lightning and male sexuality. The way the movement and the rhythm fit together hits a sweet spot for me.
Adelman is now a professional Afro-Cuban dancer, going on tours and performing. She says she feels something in the class, but for her, it's not her chosen religion.
I think you see a lot of Jews who practice Santeria because you can have it be part of your culture and not your full belief system. And, you know, just like they can say, oh, you're a Jew-boo, like a Jewish Buddhist. There's many things. I haven't heard a name of, like, I'm trying to think what it would be like, a Jew-santa. I don't know.
A few people are very aware of how this class overlaps with and departs from Santeria. One of them is Carolyn Brandy. She's one of the three women playing the bata drums.
It's not a secular context. We're teaching people how to play, sing, and dance for Orisha. It's not like a social music that we're playing in that class.
Brandy is tall and has peppered gray hair. She commands the attention of the room when she plays the drums. In a traditional Santeria ceremony, sacred drums that have been blessed would only be played by men. She knows these religious rules well.
I'm a santera. I became a priest in Cuba in the year 2000. And I'm a priest for Obatala, which is the snow-capped mountains.
Not many dancers in the class realize that Brandy is a priest. To many, she's just the drummer that seems to play all of the rhythms with ease. Brandy says these sessions are part of her Santeria practice.
I have Native American blood, and so I've always believed that the powers of the earth are sacred. And so that really appealed to me in this religion. It's very, very firmly rooted in music, this religion. And it's, I like that. It's beautiful. And you don't have to be Cuban or African or whatever. It's something that touches the human beingness.
I tell Brandy about my experience living in Cuba, a place that I know well. I spent years studying there, and it's where I went to my first Santeria ceremony. Neighbors and friends crowded in a small living room. Men wearing white played the bata drums. A woman began to dance. Slow, intricate moves that turned into convulsive-like movements. Shaking, screaming, eyes wide. I was told she'd been taken by the spirit. Carolyn Brandy tells me this wouldn't likely happen at a dance class. But she says there are places you can experience this deeper side of Santeria in the Bay Area. Like at her home.
This is my altar for Obatala. It's my personal altar.
I meet Brandy in San Leandro, where she invites me into her living room. It's like walking into a shrine. Altars to gods line the walls.
Obatala's animal is the snail, so I've got lots of different snails. Here's Yemaya. She's got her blue and white.
Brandy recently had a religious ceremony at her home. She moved out tables and chairs, set up drums, and people dancing were overcome by orishas in the middle of her living room.
The goal is to have somebody go into a trance. When orisha comes down through people, they do amazing things. There's a lot of healing that goes on there.
Healing. The same word some of the dancers at Dance Mission Theater used to describe the experience of these Afro-Cuban folkloric classes. As the women drummers begin to play, and the dancers follow teacher Susana Pedroso across the floor, some of their faces begin to twist and change, some of their eyes widen, and the drums respond with more force. People begin to sing the call and response of the orishas. Dancers, drummers, the entire class. people know the words to the Orisha songs, and others just improvise, moved by the need to let something out, no matter if it's part of their religious practice or not. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
That story is part of our project, The Spiritual Edge, Stories at the Intersection of Innovation and Belief. Find more from The Spiritual Edge at kalw.org. It's also where you can get tickets to the Cuba Caribe Dance Festival happening next month. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Recognize this music? Well, it's by John Santos. Santos is a 5-time Grammy-nominated percussionist in the Afro-Latin tradition. He's a San Francisco native who chose to explore his family's roots in Puerto Rico and Cape Verde through his music. His career as an educator, composer, writer, and performer spans more than 35 years. When it comes to exploring how Latinos have influenced American music, he first asks us to consider how we use the word American.
Because what we call American music, you know, it's skewed by how we grew up being taught that the United States equals America. And it's the music, more than anything I know, that proves that to be totally false. You know, the North America and Central America, South America, the Caribbean are all equally American. So the music, you know, doesn't have those kind of boundaries.
John Santos says to really appreciate the influence Latinos have had on American music, you need to focus on the music. And as he told KALW's Martina Castro, the best place to start is jazz.
When we talk about jazz, we generally talk about the roots of jazz being the blues, rightfully so, and spiritual music from the southern part of our country, also rightfully so, and some work songs and things that come from the fields and come out of the tradition of slavery, the horrible tradition of slavery. And those are all legitimate roots of jazz, as well as Western European classical music. So that's all good, but the conversation generally stops there, and it doesn't consider the fact that probably the strongest roots of jazz are the Afro-Caribbean roots of jazz. And I say that because New Orleans is the birthplace of jazz. And New Orleans is as Caribbean a place as San Juan or Havana or Cartagena or Veracruz or Kingston or Port-au-Prince or any of the major ports on the Caribbean. And it's connected with those ports for hundreds of years throughout the colonial period. So economically and socially and culturally, it's totally connected. And there's always been movement, ships going between all those ports and workers going to follow the harvest season to work. And of course, there were many musicians among those workers. And that's why the Caribbean area has this kind of a trademark, or maybe that's not the right word, but one of the key elements of the Caribbean is this Creole-ness, this Creole atmosphere that New Orleans, of course, is the epitome of that in our country, but that's common throughout the Caribbean. And that's the environment in which jazz was born. You know, we could look at any type of American music and trace back and find the Afro-Latino, Afro-Caribbean, and Latino roots in the music.
Are there any particular artists or songs that pop out in your mind and you could say, you know, listen to this little, you know, rhythm section. Listen to how this artist is doing this. Like, is there something that maybe...
There's tons of stuff. You know, for example, if we look at hip-hop music and we look at what the basis of hip-hop music, the basis has a lot to do with a rhythm that is very Afro-Caribbean that's called clave, the clave rhythm that goes like this. And that rhythm is something that comes to the Americas with enslaved Africans and with and their descendants. And it's a very African concept that has influenced all of the African diaspora music, from jazz to samba to rumba to song to plena to merengue to calypso to tango in Argentina, and all up and down the Americas, the music has this concept is part of the music. Now, in hip-hop music, the connection is that hip-hop is based on this kind of beatbox type of rhythm where it's imitating the sound of the kick drum and the snare drum. And that's a simple version. Of course, there are many variations, but that rhythm itself is a composite of the clave. Many variations of it. But there's this feel of the clave. And the hip-hop music is rooted in that. Then we could look at, in rock and roll, you know, rock and roll is born out of rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues is another New Orleans invention. And New Orleans is a place where the clave is super big. Super, it's the most common rhythm that unites New Orleans music. So in the second line, what they call second line music that's played in Mardi Gras and the carnival in the streets, they use that rhythm. And it's played on usually on the snare drum and with the bass drum. And you hear that accent of the clave. You hear it like this. So it's the same feel, same rhythm. It's very pan-Caribbean African influence. So from New Orleans, that goes into rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues, we could think of some people in the audience are probably will remember Bo Diddley, who was one of the pioneers of rhythm and blues. He was a New Orleans musician. And he had his people would call it the Bo Diddley rhythm, his thing. And it was the clave. And he would play it, though. This is indicative of what happened in the States, is that the African element was so cut off and alienated in the States that those Africanisms evolved on European instruments. So they would play it on the bass or on the guitar, and he had a rhythm. For example, he had a song, and I can't remember all the words, but it was something like, hey, little girl in the venue, sweat up, pink, 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 da-da. Totally based on the clave. And that is, you know, part and parcel of rhythm and blues. And they would play those rhythms on the saxophones or on the different instruments that they use, and that gave birth to rock and roll. So all of the early rock and roll artists, from Chuck Berry to Elvis Presley, they all used that rhythm and used that clave as the basis of what they do. And then as we come further, if we look at Motown, for example, Motown music, Motown 90% of the time, all the Motown music had conga drums in it. They used conga, and the conga is epitome of Afro, Central African in particular, music and rhythm. So if you listen, go back and listen to all the hits of the Supremes, the Temptations, the Four Tops, the beginning of the funk thing, James Brown always had a conga drummer in his band. They always had congas. So through jazz that comes from New Orleans, through rhythm and blues that comes from New Orleans, and the rock and roll that was born out of that rhythm and blues, it really has to do with a great root of American music in the States. Louie, it's a very Latino thing. And actually that vamp, that bass line, comes directly from a piece that was written by, René Toussaint, a Cuban band leader who had a tune called Loco Chacha. The Loco Chacha had that same bass line and that same line. It started out the same way. Ba-da-dum, be-dee, be-dee-dee, da-da. And that was just lifted directly out of that and formed the basis of Louie Louie. If you say Latin music, you know, that's, you couldn't say anything more general. There's nothing specific about that. And it's similar to saying jazz. If you say jazz, there's many kinds of jazz. Jazz is not a specific thing by any means. It's more of a state of mind than anything else, because there's specific styles of music. There's ragtime, there's swing, there's bebop, there's Dixieland. And those are styles of music, and they're all types of jazz. And it's evolved a lot. And so there's other styles. There's Latin jazz, there's contemporary jazz, and all kinds of things. And the art, it teaches us. If we just, you know, it teaches us about that we need to be open about this, because we can't discuss honestly the roots of the music at all if we're not going to be honest about the history and what it represents. Indicative of the dilemma and of the problem is something that's happened recently in our country, which is that the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences has recently eliminated 31 categories from Grammy consideration. And the categories, among the categories that were eliminated, are contemporary jazz, Latin jazz, a category of rhythm and blues, a category of gospel music, Native American music, Cajun music, zydeco, instrumental rock, and some of the most important roots and creative music forms that we have in this country. And this is a nonprofit organization that whose mission is to showcase and honor American music in the United States and represent all the creativity. It's like a peer award. It's supposed to be not like American Idol, not a popularity contest. And yet they have become that. It's part of the battle that's important for us to fight, and we can't let them get away with it.
That was John Santos speaking with KALW's Martina Castro. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. And now it's time for the book report brought to you by the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
For the book report, we ask Bay Area writers to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today we hear from Colin Winnette, a writer living in San Francisco.
My book report is on Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead by Barbara Comins. This book is about largely about the Willoweed family in an English village that has a apparently like infectious madness moving through it. And it seems it's just this kind of nightmarish landscape where one person loses their mind after another. But it's written in a very light and very enjoyable and funny way, even though it's extremely dark and very violent. She's so sly and so witty, and her prose is so, what's the word? Sort of tender, even though she's describing these horrible things. I'm going to read the first paragraph of the book. All around there was a wheezy creaking noise as the water soaked into unaccustomed places, and in the distance, a roar, and above it, the shouts of men trying to rescue animals from the low-lying fields. A passing pig squealing, its short legs madly beating the water and tearing at its throat, which was red and bleeding, and a large flat-bottomed boat followed with men inside. The boat whirled round and round in the fierce current, but eventually the pig was saved, and squealed even louder. The children, Hattie and Dennis, watched the rescue from a bedroom window, and suddenly the sun came out very bright and strong, and everywhere became silver. Old Ives below said, "It's a bad thing for the sun to shine on a flood. It draws the dampness back to the sky." The grandmother came and joined them, and they talked together in the veranda. There was a great smell of mud, and it was the 1st of June. I was a very serious young man as an undergrad student, and so after a while I realized I was not having any fun. And I was reading these monster books that were like purposefully, like aggressively challenging in every way. And I was wasting a lot of time because I was reading a lot of books that I did not like absorb and did not want to be reading. Even though I read some that I really loved and really learned a lot from, but that I started looking for work that was not that. But eventually it brought me to a book like this, which is very smart. So it was this immediate lesson for me about how much darker you can go if you don't necessarily like make your prose also dark and difficult and angular and sharp. It feels so
direct and plain, and it's such a relief. It's like a balm, you know, to read these nice smooth sentences that are painful and deep and brilliant, but they're not hitting you over the head with their brilliance. They're just kind of like laying you down in bed and tucking you goodnight and being like, here's a little nightmare for you to have later. Here's the void. It's a special book, you know? It's one of those books that it was rare and feels very unique.
That was San Francisco writer Colin Winnett talking about Barbara Komen's book, Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead. This book report was produced by Nina Gensler-Debs for The Litography Project. So what are you reading these days? Tell us on our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You can also send us an email at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, and Todd Whitney. Seth Samuel engineered today's show. Our line producers were Leela Day and Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, who you heard from earlier in the show. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.